Good evening. My name is Sheila Armstrong, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sheila.
I want to thank the committee for asking me and Bill. It's getting a little cold in here again, honey. Brr. I want to thank you. He kept a lot of contact with me to make sure what time my plane was arriving. A lot of contact all the time. He was real worried about my plane. And that's really nice, and I'm certainly glad I made it here. And Sherry, Susan said today, she said they just couldn't have had anyone more perfect pick us up. And I'll tell you what, she just walked straight over to us. I mean, it's like, do I still look like a drunk? You know, it's so funny. And we were too. We were just, you know, just, and she just walked right, are you from Norman? I'm like, oh, I just gave her a hug. And it's like, you just know each other. And we weren't in the car 2 minutes, and she asked me about a fellow in Norman, Oklahoma. And I mean, Norman's not real super tiny. It's like, you know, 60, 70,000 people. And she asked me about this one man. And I worked for him when he was drinking. I was sober. I was about 90 days sober, worked with this nut. And she worked for him, too, so we were just right in the same car, you know. And oh, yeah. And I said, you know, I saw him about 2 weeks ago at a meeting, and he's been sober for 3 years. And she said, oh, I've got chill bumps. And that's just this program. That's what has happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over again. And it's because I show up. You know, like my sponsor used to say, you know, God can't work any miracles if you're going to sit at home. And, you know, so many times I had to remember that, you know, a lot of times I want to sit and I loved your talk, Reggie. I really loved your talk and our Italian stallion and, and the Italian stallion of Alcoholics Anonymous right here. And so, and I love that what he was talking about, you know, you just, I mean, my favorite subject most of my life has been me and thinking about me, and I am just so self-obsessed, and it's just, I'm just a sick individual. And my sponsor spotted that immediately, I don't know how. And, you know, she had me do things, a lot of things, like clean ashtrays and wash coffee cups and just, you know, I thought this was busy work. She was a teacher, by the way, and I thought she was just having me do busy work all the time. And you know, because of some of those things, and I show up at places, you know, wonderful things get to happen. You know, that's what the book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me, you know, that remarkable things will happen if you just come and you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. You know, and it's just, and that was so hard for me to do, and I always was always told, you know, good orderly direction. And I didn't have any good orderly direction when I got here. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. I was born in Oklahoma. I thought that's probably why I drank for a while, but I had lots of excuses. And I was born to two normal alcoholic parents, and they did normal alcoholic things. They were divorced before I ever remember them being married. My father moved away to California. I don't remember him in my early childhood. And my mother, I thought my mother was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I just thought she was so pretty and neat, and she was a nurse, and I remember she'd come and get us at school, and I always felt so proud of her, and I just loved her, and she was an alcoholic, and, you know, she did alcoholic things, you know, like, drive wrong on the street, wrong ways, you know, and we'd go to bars with her, and she, you know, she took us with her a lot of times, and then she started coming up missing a lot. She would go off on sprees, and she'd leave us with my grandmother, and she just would sometimes not come back for like a long time, months at a time. I remember one time she was reported missing, and all I ever really wanted, well, I just wanted her to come home. I don't really remember being real angry at her. I just loved her, and I just wanted her to come home. And a lot of times I would think, and I had a younger brother who's younger than me, and I would think, you know, if I could be a better kid, or what did I do? You know, I must have done something, and no one ever said I did anything, and that's just how, you know, I perceived it. I must have done something. And when we were about 6, 7 years old, we were placed in a foster home. We were living with my grandmother, and the social workers came, and they took us away, and because my grandmother was pretty old, and we went to live in this foster home, and we were there, and the foster parents told us that my father was coming from California, and he was going to come and get custody of us. And I thought, oh, okay, you know. And he walked in. I'll never forget this. he walked in the room, and my father's a rather large man. And when you're little, he's even bigger, you know. When you're a kid, you know. And he had this big voice. I got his voice. And and my mother's eyes and my father's voice. And so he walks in, he had Thumbelina doll in one hand and a mitt for my brother in the other, you know, and he's like, "Hi, I'm Dad," you know, and just right off, I was like, "This is not going to quite work." I just felt it. And my brother just cried, and he was so excited to have a dad. And I just thought he just seemed kind of scary and mean. And I was right. He got custody of us, and we moved to California. And I never saw my mother again until I was 19 years old. And today, because of this program, I know with all my heart that that's the very best she could do. You know, that's just the very, very best. She just never showed up to court, you know. And I understand, you know. I understand today. I understand this program has given me so, so much. She just couldn't face it, you know. And we didn't see her again until I was 19 years old. And I went to live with my dad, and he had married a wonderful lady, a Mexican lady, and she was neat. And we got off the plane, and there were just hundreds of people, relatives, and there were just hundreds of them. And they were hugging and kissing and loving, and I just, wow, you know, it was just, I love excitement, you know. And I'm in California. I remember the freeway. I thought that was the most exciting thing, and I love to go fast from get-go. You know, we just went fast. And I thought if I had, you know, I look back on Piedmont, Oklahoma, I would have died if I'd lived there. I'd never been a good drunk, you know. I'd have been a real boring drunk. And so, but I just love California, and it was exciting. And this lady was a wonderful lady, and she tried to love us, and she did, and she was good to us. And unfortunately, my father's disease was progressing along too, and there was something going on in that home, and it was the disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know that. And one day we got up, and she was gone, and my father said she had to go take care of her brother who was ill. And I did not see that lady again until I was 18 years old, and she just went away. I know that she didn't have Al-Anon. You know, she didn't have a solution. She just had to go. We went to Phoenix, Arizona right after that and lived with my aunt and uncle, which were neat people, and they took care of us. And my father was in lots of trouble. I remember being so afraid for him. He was in trouble, and he had done some things. And through his drinking, he was looking at going to jail. And you know, I'm a little kid, and I'm worrying about stuff like this. You know, I was just old. I just started out old. And I would worry. I mean, I knew how to make a bloody beer when I was 6 years old, you know, from my mother's hangovers, you know, and know how to get the aspirin. I was just old. And the thing is that today I look back on those things, and I have been had so much help in this program to work through so much. And it's through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it in Al-Anon. And I found it in no other place. For me, we lived there. My father, I heard, had gotten sober. He got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it didn't really thrill me or do anything. It was like, that's nice. And so we went back to live. We were supposed to go live with him. But we had become, I guess, wards of the state of the court or something. And we had to go to another foster home because he was just getting sober. And he lived in a 12-step house. And back then it was on Beacon Street. And I'll never forget that. And we went to see him. And we drove up. And I noticed he looked different. There was something about him that was different. It was probably his eyes. And he didn't seem quite as mean as he had in the past. And he even lost a little weight. And he looked pretty good. And so we had to go to this foster home. And we were supposed to stay there 2 weeks. And we ended up staying there 3.5 years. And it was a black foster home. And there was so much love in that home. My foster mother, I believe that God sent angels to take care of me. And it's just one of those things that there were so many people that took care of my brother and I, and we were together the whole time. We weren't separated. And I believe that that was just God. And these people I like to call them my angels, that God has angels, and they just take care of kids. I think that just, to me, is just the neatest. And this woman loved us so much. We were her very first foster children. Today, she still even calls us her blue-eyed babies, and we are her blue-eyed babies. And I still am in contact with this lady today. And, you know, she had a beautiful room. And she just did everything that just loved us. And she was a good lady. And her husband was a good man. And her son was there. And I remember we were going to sit down and eat lunch. And he came in and he said, "I don't want a white boy sleeping in my room." And I thought, oh, this ought to be fun. You know. And he got in lots of trouble for that. But, you know, it was like... And we just meshed, and more kids came to the home, and there was a Mexican girl named Hilda, and I just loved her, and she was neat and a nice, and she had, you know, we all had our stories, you know, each kid had a story, and then another kid came to the home, and he was an Indian boy, and he was 18 months old, and that was my little baby. I just took care of him right off, and it was funny that you mentioned United Nations, Reggie, because that's what I always say. It, you know, when we all sat down for dinner, it looked like a meeting of the Junior United Nations, you know, and it was just so neat. And unfortunately, there was prejudice outside the home, you know, and it wasn't good. And I started to learn what prejudice was and why. And I'd go home and ask my foster mother questions, and she would just say, it's ignorance, you know. And I remember not liking my own color. I wish if I could be black, I could fit in here. If I had been Mexican and spoke Spanish, maybe she wouldn't have left. If I'd been a better kid, if only I was something other than I was. And I just wanted to always be something I wasn't. I wanted to be anything but who I really was, and I hated who I was, and that's how I came to this program, not wanting to be who I am. My father got custody of us back. He married a nice lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had two kids, and he had two kids, and we got together, and it was not the Brady Bunch. It not work out that way. I wish it had. I remember watching that show, hoping and wishing. But they were two nice people, and it just didn't work out. So I went to live with her sister, an aunt, this lady's sister, and my brother and I did. And my dad lived down the street from us, and we would drive by, and I'd wave, and they'd go, "Who's that?" And I'd go, "That's my dad." And they said, "You live down the street from your dad?" And I said, "Yeah, don't you?" You know, because I love what the big book says, you know, the abnormal becomes normal. I mean, that was normal to me. And it's like, you mean your parents have been married all their lives together, and you only have one dad and mom, and that's weird to me. And so we lived down the street from dad, and I would go and see him, and we started to have problems, and I just never seemed to. We just always had clashed. I got asked to the prom. You know, I started getting into school, and my aunt was so nice. She was going to fix it. She was going to fix my life. I mean, she really wanted to do all these neat things for me. And so I went to the prom. This guy asked me, he's like, "Well, you don't have a date, and I don't have a date. You want to go to the prom?" Well, how romantic, yes. And so we went to the search for the dress, you know, that's so exciting. And I picked out this low-cut, straight, yellow dress, you know, and she picked out this hideous green dress with a big giant green flowers on it, and the neck was way up to here. It looked like something Debbie Reynolds would rent, and it was just, oh. And she said, "Oh, Sheila, please wear this one. It's so beautiful." And I just thought, oh, that's a terrible dress. But I really wasn't a part of their family. I remember my cousin who lives here, and she's going to come here tomorrow, she used to say, her daughter would say, "Why don't you be a part of Sheila? You know, why don't you be with us? Come and sit with the family. Always wanting, you're always apart from." And I would. I just didn't. Family stuff just made me weird. I didn't like it. I didn't fit in with it, and I just was not right. And so I thought, I ought to be a nice kid and get this dress. You know, maybe that I can fit in or something. So I got this dress, and then she said, "Well, Sheila, will you go to the hairdresser, my hairdresser?" And nobody went to the hairdresser, I'm sure. You know, you wore your hair long and straight, maybe a little curled at the ends, but you didn't go get a hairdo. And so I said yes. I meant no. And I went. I went. And the lady, my hair was this big. It was huge. And then my aunt comes in and said, "Oh, you look so beautiful," and had this baby's breath. So they plucked this green and white baby's breath in my hair, you know. And so me and my hair go out to the car. And I'm, oh, and so I get in, and I just hate it. And so everything, you know, and oh, gosh. And another thing that happened, a few days before the prom, the guy that, Prince Charming, that I went with, he decided for a bet he would bite the head off of a live frog. And my cousin, and all these people come running over at the recess. "Guess what? The guy you're going to the prom with just bit the head off a live frog." And I thought, can anything ever go right just once? You know, it's just, I was so disgusted. And my dad gets invited to my aunt's, and everybody's there. My foster mother came, and they're clicking the pictures, and I've got this hideous green dress on, and I've got this hideous hair and baby's breath. And the guy walks in, and my little cousin, my younger cousin, comes up and he goes, "Are you the guy that bit the head off a live frog?" Right in front of everybody. And my dad goes, "Oh, my God," you know, gave me that look like, here she goes, you know. And I thought, and I just felt one more time, you know, it's never enough. I love my dad. I wanted his approval so bad, but I did everything I could to push him away. It was like, love me, love me, love me, and I did everything I could to just push him away. I pushed every button I could, and I like to say that I can make the veins in that man's neck stand out better than anyone. You know, I can roar, and his face is red and fights on. And we had the most volatile, violent relationship. And I was a big part of that. I have looked at a lot of that. And that's because of this program. I looked at my side of stuff, not his. I didn't take his inventory when I did an inventory. I took my inventory. And anyway, so we go off to the prom, and I'm like, oh, gosh. And we're going, and he said, would you like a sip of this? And I said, yes. And I mean, it was wonderful. And it was kept having little sips. It was a little champagne glass. And I thought, well, I won't get drunk on this, you know. And of course, they mixed everything in it, you know, and we went to the prom, and then after prom, then I drank, and I remember it just started feeling right, you know. And Clancy talks about the disease of perception, and I love that, because it's like my hair got long and straight, and that those green flowers flew off that dress, and frog lips started looking pretty good. You know what I mean? Whoa. Found my prince. You know, make me another drink, bud. And I blacked out and passed out my very first time. And that wasn't my very first drink. I think I had sipped beer before. But, I mean, that was my first drunk. That's what I remember. I don't remember the sips. And, you know, I think I sipped when I was a teeny kid, probably. But that was my first drunk. And you know, the next day I felt horrible. And I thought, oh, gosh, I'm glad I wasn't caught. That was the thing. I wasn't caught. I was so glad. And I didn't just, you know, go into full-blown alcoholism. I partied. It was partying for me at first. It was just fun. It was good times and don't get caught. And I got out of high school. And one thing that did happen when I was about 16 is my foster sister, Hilda, who I just loved, had her family did not want her in a black foster home. They wanted her with her own people or whatever. And so they moved her to a foster home, and it was a very bad situation there. And she killed herself when we were 16. And I remember I went to her funeral, and I was so angry at God because she had such a horrible life up to this point anyway, except for the time she had been with Betty and Leo. Except for that, I thought, well, you know, I just couldn't understand her family, and they were all crying, and they were so upset, but I thought, what? I don't understand. And I just was so angry and bitter of my life, and I just got more bitter. And the more bitter I got, the more I drank, and the more I drank. And I got out of high school, and I could not wait to get away from them, whoever them are. And I was gonna show them how you live life, and I was gonna do the right thing. And I got into waitressing, and gosh, what, for an alcoholic, that's heaven. You know, you go fast, and there's people, and it was neat. And I just did food waitressing, and I came in real hungover one morning, and this girl was there, and we worked the early shift, and she said, "Well, you look pretty rough," and I said, "Yeah." And I said, "I'm just dying." She said, "Here, take one of these. You'll be zipping around in no time." I took one of those and zipped around for 2 days. I made a lot of tips, too, I'll have you know. And I mean, it was like, and what I found was that, and I'm an alcoholic, pure and simple, but what drugs did for me is that it enabled me to drink more, you know, and get there faster. And so I'm going fast again. And I found more things, and drugs became more a part of my life. And then I need to get myself together and get straightened out. And I really was flipping out. So when I was about 20 years old, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to AA meetings at the Pacific Group in California. I stayed sober 9 months. I didn't work steps. You know, I found a hymn. I did all the things they suggest that you don't do. I started out pretty good. I'm a great starter. I don't finish diddly, but I started out great. And then I started getting into my self-will, which has ruined my life. You know, it ruins me. And I did all the things they say they suggest not to do, so I did them. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, AA just isn't for me. And I left. And I had an 8-year slip. And I finally, I did get back 8 years later. And so right after that I thought, you know, I probably need to find a hymn and get married. I had lots of hymns. Like, you know, boys and booze. I mean, they go together. Booze and boys and booze. I mean, you know, it's like soup and sandwich. And so, I'm as sick in one area as I am in the other. So, I went to find a hymn, and I did, and I met him in a bar, and he owned it, and it was love to me. We got married. We were married 6 whole months, and that did not work out. And he was an okay guy, I guess. And it was like gasoline and a match together, you know, poof. I mean, and that was all my relationships with men. It was just gasoline and a match, you know, I just light and we just go. And it was like violent relationships and, you know, it's like, boom, I'm going, you know, if I'm going through a window, I'm saying I love you on the way out. You know, that was my idea of love. Just always stirring it up and sickness and, but I love you. And so I'd like to stand and you're not leaving at the door kind of stuff. I did that. And I really did identify with Al-Anon women. I did. I did a lot of that stuff. And then I'd finally say, I'm going to get drunk and go to bed. You know, this is ridiculous. And I used to sit in Al-Anon meetings because I had to kind of go in the beginning because when I first got sober, I'll tell you that later. But I would sit there and I identified with them, but it was like, God, take a Valium and go to bed. He'll be home. Have a drink. It'll be fine, you know. I mean, because to a point I'd obsess, and then my other friend, booze, worked, you know, and that worked fine. So I just would do that, and that's how come I got in so much trouble, and I couldn't stay in Al-Anon. So that's why I didn't stay in Al-Anon very long. But so... after that, my mother got very ill, and I had seen my mother at 19. It was a horrible visit. We went to see each other. I went to see her in Texas. She had moved to Dallas, and it wasn't that pretty lady anymore. She was old, and the disease of alcoholism. She wasn't really that old, but the disease had taken a toll on this woman, and she wasn't what I had in my mind all those years. And I wanted her to fill the void that had been there for years. And she could not do that. I can't expect a person, a human being, to fill a void. And I wanted her to do that, and she didn't, and she couldn't. And I left very, very sad, and it was just awful. And when I was about 23 years old, I got a call that she was very ill in the hospital, and I went to Dallas, Texas, and she was dying. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody die from this disease as a direct result of cirrhosis, but it's an awful death. It's an awful, sad thing. And... I walked in that room and I saw this woman who I had loved so much, and she was bloated and yellow and had tubes, and I just thought, my life is such a waste, and her life was such a waste, and I was so angry and so hurt and sad. And so I sat and read through her. She was in a coma, she didn't even know I was there, and I read to her through the night, and they tell me that a lot of times the hearing's the last to go, and so I just read to her, and I just let her know I was there. And the next day, her sisters came, and I didn't even know them. They were my aunts, and I just felt like such a part of my life was lost. And I even felt more sadness, and we were sitting outside. The doctor was examining her, and the nurse kind of came out real quickly and said, you need to come in here. And I thought, well, this is it. And we went in there, and she was sitting up. And she said, will you forgive me? And I said, yes. And she knew she was dying. And I'm so glad I said yes. I didn't learn about true forgiveness until I got to this program. When I was a year and a half sober, I had been sent to Al-Anon. And I went to Al-Anon, and on my way, I was going to a conference. And we were there, and my stepmother, Vinoy, was there, and Sue D was there, and Tracy, my stepsister, and we were playing and running and doing girl stuff, you know, and having fun. And I was just... fun. And I went to this workshop because, not because I was dealing with any issues, but because the lady who was leading it, I liked. I mean, I had, my motives were horrible, and I just liked her, and I thought she was neat, and Sue D was leading it, and I went in there, and I was sitting way in the back, and she talked about forgiveness and how she had forgiven her mother. And that lump came in my throat. And I had done an inventory by this time. I'd already done my fourth and fifth step. And I thought, when is this ever going to go away? It just keeps coming up. And this other girl stood up, Tracy. And she said, you know, my mother tried to give me this program. And I didn't take it. And I'm so glad I'm sober now. And we've made our amends. And I hope she can forgive me. And, oh, I'm ready to burst. Because I've got a million tears that I think I'm going to cry. And I'm trying not to. And... this other girl stood up and said that she had loved her mother and how they were best friends now. And, I just felt so empty inside. And I just felt horrible. And I could not wait to get out of there. You ever had one of those meetings? You got to get out of there. It's just your head's going to blow off. And so there were two doors, just like there are here. And the minute the Lord's Prayer, I wasn't crying or anything. I had put my sunglasses on, and I was just standing there. And there were two doors. and I ran out one door, not ran, but I went kind of fast, and there was, and I was going, and this other person, somebody was following me. I was going faster, and they were going faster, and so finally I stopped and turned around, and it was my stepmom. And she just hugged me, you know, and just held me, and just rocked me. And I cried, and I cried, and it was like so much pain came out of me. And she said, and we've not had any words spoken, and she said to me, Sheila, your mother loved you, and she would be proud of you, because I love you, and I'm proud of you. And it just healed my heart. And I'm so glad I showed up. And I didn't sleep in for that conference, you know. I didn't sleep in or something, or just be into myself. I just showed up, and I got this miracle that I just wanted so badly for so many years. And it was like the void got filled through it, and it was just a healing. And I've had so much healing in this program, just so much. She died. My mother died right after I had gone there, and she died on Good Friday, and I called my dad, and there were periods of time my dad didn't even know where I lived or where I was, and you know, I look back on the pain I caused that man, and you know, I didn't mean to do that ever to him. I love him very much. He's a wonderful man. And but when I was in my early 20s, I was the daughter from hell. You know, I just was, and I didn't mean to be. Well, I kind of did, but you know. I was so sick then, I figured he deserved it, you know. You abandoned me, you know, and I went through that trip, you know. And there was a year one time we didn't even talk. And I just caused him a lot of pain through my own anger, my own sickness. And I called him and I said, would you help me? And he said, yes. And we flew back to Oklahoma, and that's where they flew the body, and we buried her. And my brother came. And me and my brother and my dad, we stood around her coffin. And it's the first time I ever remember us all being together. You know, and I think she would have liked that. And I loved her. And I love her today. And I love my dad. My dad has been sober for 26 years. And most of that, I caused him a lot of pain in those years, you know. I really did, and one of the things that happened for me in this program was steps 8 and 9, and that's looking at me and making my amends, like Reggie was talking about. I found another him after this. I divorced my husband right in the middle of all this. I was getting divorced, and I divorced that him, and I found a couple others, and then I found another one, and I got pregnant, and he didn't want to be, but I was, so... Oh, well. And we lived together, and my father had moved to Oklahoma by this time. He had found the, like he told me, Sheila, I found a princess. I said, another one? He's been married 5 times. And I said, oh, how splendid for you. She's an Al-Anon. I said, well, thank God. She's going to need to be. And they had moved to Oklahoma, and he had started this beautiful marriage, and I got pregnant, and you know, 9 months and 2 days after their wedding, their first grandchild was born. Guess what I was doing and on their wedding day. Anyway, that's why I didn't go to their wedding. If I had gone to their wedding, my whole life would be different. How weird. I'm glad I stayed home. This him left me at 8 months pregnant. And, you know, one more time, I feel abandoned, and I feel ugly, and I feel useless, and I feel worthless. And he left, and through, of course, inventories in this program, and through a lot of the men in this program, I've heard your stories. I've heard your pain when you left a kid and left a wife or a girlfriend. I understand that you just didn't do that and never feel anything. I understand that was part of your disease. And I learned forgiveness through you all and watching you today pay child support and care and do those things. And it's just given me a healing when I hear men come up here and talk. He left, and this baby was born to me, and I drank and I did use drugs while I was pregnant, and that is not a pretty part of my story, and it's not, I drank and used through all of this stuff, and I wish I could have been one of those women. I've heard women alcoholics say, you know, I got pregnant and I just shaped up, and God, I wished I had. And my sponsor told me that I was not a bad girl getting good, that we were sick people getting well, and that I was sick when I did those things. I was not bad. And it's been a real hard road to really forgive myself for that, because he's such a sweet boy. He was born healthy, which is just but for the grace of God. And I had this baby, and I thought he's the most beautiful baby in the whole world. And I was going to love him, and he was going to fix it, and I was going to shape up, and I wasn't going to drink, and I wasn't going to drug, and I was going to get a good job, and I was going to do all the things. And I had the most wonderful intentions, and the big book talks about that. You know, I judge myself by my intentions while the world judges me by my actions. My actions were terrible as a mother. You know, he fixed me for 2 weeks, and that was it. And that's the best he could do. And I was out partying and running around again. And I continued just going crazy. I moved to San Diego with another him, a Marine. I thought he'd protect me. Well, he didn't. And supposed to protect the world. And that didn't work out, and I was alone, and I ended up in I used to work in very nice, beautiful restaurants, and I became a cocktail waitress. I love cocktail waitressing. Oh, and you were talking about the tinkling of the glass and the lights. Oh, it's just it's just yummy. I love that. And I'm in control, because if you're not nice to me, you don't get a drink. You know, so I'm in control. And it's, you know, and one for you and one for me. And, you know, I didn't get in trouble. It's like, I never lost a job through drinking. You know, I could always say that, but huh. And it was like, you know, I was really never drunk on the job. You know, any of those things, a lot of the big book, I could still walk in with denial and still pick out my I nevers, which was ridiculous. After I got honest, I had them all. I did it all. And what happened at that point was I was sleeping. I was working in a bowling alley as a waitress. Not a nice, pretty place with flowers and plants. And I was a bowling alley waitress. And it was a hardcore bowling alley, and it was Marines that got paid, and they'd come in, and they, you know, ate glass, and ugh, you know, and it was like, boy, I've really hit the big time now. And I was sleeping on the floor at a girlfriend's house, and that's where I had gone to, and I came sneaking in at 5 a.m. one morning, and she said, you know, if it weren't for this baby, you wouldn't be living here. I'd have you out and your stuff, what little you have, on the street. And I said, well, whatever. And I just made up excuses. And I had woke up and I had these sores all over me, and I didn't know what they were, and I thought it was nerves, and I wasn't sure, and I had been drinking and doing a lot of drugs, and I was doing all this stuff, and I couldn't imagine. It was anything. It was probably something I ate, probably that cherry pie. You know, it was never, I never could, you know, equate, you know, booze is doing, you know, I've got something going on with this alcohol. Well, I woke up this one morning and I was crazy, and I called my dad. Now, for me to call my parents is the bottom of the barrel. I don't call dad in AA, you know, because then he'll know something's wrong, and I don't want him to know. I always just kind of snuck away from him. And I called, and I got his wife. And I said, I just want to tell you, I was at the end. It was at the jumping off place we talked about in the big book. And I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to walk the streets, and I'm going to put Brad in a foster home. Now, I'm about to do the same thing to my child that was done to me that I swore I would never do, because that's all I knew. And I said, I just can't live this way anymore. And she said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Now, if it's the end, don't call an Al-Anon. I don't suggest, if you know, if you want it to be the real end, don't ever get an Al-Anon on the other line, because they will fix it. So, she said, your dad's doing a fifth step right now, but we'll call you right back. Now, don't go anywhere. Well, I hung up the phone. All of a sudden, I realized what I've just confessed almost. Well, I did what any good drunk does. I went and got drunk. And they called back, and they kept saying, where were you? I said, oh, I went to the grocery store. For 3 hours? Yeah, it was a big line. So my dad and I eventually got on the phone, and he was not happy, and he kept wanting to know what was wrong, and I kept saying, I just can't make it, I just can't make it, and I made no sense. He said, Sheila, I will send you a one-way airline ticket to Norman, Oklahoma. Not money. He sent it the ticket. I mean, he wasn't dumb. He knew what to do. If he had sent me money, I don't know if I'd be right here. If he had sent me money to fix it, I don't think I'd have been here. And so he sent me an airline ticket. And I got on the plane, and I thought my life was over. And it was just the worst day of my whole life, and I'd ruined my life. And all I've got is a couple of boxes with twine around it and my baby and a buggy. And it was just put in this old beat-up suitcase that I won't get rid of. My husband hates it, and he wants to throw it away, but it was this old beat-up suitcase. I just love it. Anyway, so I arrive in Oklahoma and I'm acting like everything's normal. I've got heels on this high, carrying a baby through two airports. That's logical. I had to look good while I was doing that, I guess. I had my hair all swooped up on one side and this black outfit on. I had this black eyeliner. Looking like, Miss Mom, right? And I don't remember changing planes actually in Denver, and I was in a blackout because the plane was late and they were giving free champagne away, and I said, of course. But I got to Tulsa and I started drinking coffee. I remember drinking coffee because we landed in Tulsa and we were going to Oklahoma, and I thought, I got to act, get myself together. I'm going to the AA Al-Anon home. And so Benoit picked me up. My dad didn't even pick me up at the airport, and that's the kind of relationship we started out with, in this program. He couldn't even face it. And people today tell the story of him pacing the clubhouse back and forth, knowing that my plane had just arrived, and he didn't want to go home. He was washing ashtrays, Can I help you, son? You tell the newcomer to go over and wash some ashtrays, and he's over there helping him. I think I'll help. He just stayed at that meeting and stayed and stayed, and everybody kept saying, gosh, I wonder when Jim's going to get home, And I'm like, he probably won't if I'm here. So they took me, and I remember her and this other Al-Anon lady, Susan, I just love her, and they drive me by the clubhouse. Here's where our AA meetings are. Oh, that's cool. How nice. I was thrilled. Oh, that's nice for you. I was trying to look for the bar, if I see any flashing neon lights or anything, and so we went to home, and Dad came in, and it was just so uncomfortable, and just friction everywhere, and I was sober and for 6 weeks, not sober, dry. I didn't go to meetings. I just slept and I was hanging on is what I was doing. I was just hanging on. I went to some Al-Anon meetings because in that house you have to go to something. So I went to Al-Anon because you could drink. I'm not going to admit, I got drunk with my Al-Anon sponsor and her sponsor happened to be my stepmother. So they told. And it was probably when I was tearing a door down that kind of triggered her. She might not be a normal drinker. I was tearing a door down in a bathroom somewhere. I don't know. I don't even know. Remember doing that too much. But Debbie still tells the story. I was beating a door down or something. And so she started feeling guilty and told her. And then they confronted me, of course. And I just said, you all are such goofs. You think everyone's an alcoholic in the whole world. I'm out of here. Found these girls to live with. Doing the same thing in 5 minutes. And I thought, if I move to Oklahoma, maybe I'll get my life together. Maybe I won't party so much. Maybe it's the beach people. Maybe it's the drugs. Maybe if only I could get in the right place. I thought I'd meet some nice guy and we'd raise chickens together or something in Oklahoma. Well, I just took myself with me. And I was so sick that all the sickness kept happening. Well, I had one night where we'd had a party at our apartment and I put my baby to bed. And I came to the next morning. I had mud all over me and I couldn't find my baby. And I didn't remember. I remember putting him in bed, but I don't remember anything after that. And he should have been in bed, and he wasn't. And I got up, and I ran around the apartment, and I was opening, doors, bedroom doors, trying to find him. And it was December the 15th, 1984, and it was cold, 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 like it's cold, cold, cold. I thought, my God, he's gone outside, and he's froze to death. And my heart was beating, and I was praying and praying, and please, God, let him be all right. And I was running around, and I ran outside, and I was screaming his name. And my roommates got up and said, what is wrong? And I said, I can't find Bradford. And he came out right behind her. And he was right behind her. And he had those little jammies on, the feet in them. And he held his arms up and he said, Ma. And it was like I had, what the book talks about, a moment of clarity. And I just saw everything that I was doing for the first time. Not what everyone else had done. I saw what I was doing. I was doing the same exact thing. I was doing the same exact thing that I said I would never do. I saw my mother's life, I saw my life, and I saw the parallel, and I saw the end, where it was just almost exactly the same. And I said, God, please help me. That's exactly what I said. I hugged that baby, and I said, Mama's going to get help. And I called some people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous through my father, and she wasn't home, but he was. And he said, Sheila, I know a little bit more about you than I'm supposed to. He said, are you drunk? And I said, no, I'm just real hungover. He said, well, get your butt over here. And I got my car and I drove over there, and she came home later and they gave me coffee and they talked to me and they 12-stepped me that day. And I'm glad they answered their phone. I'm glad he wasn't too tired. I'm glad he didn't unplug it, because it was his day off or something, because I don't know if I'd have made another call. I may have, but I don't know. And I'm so glad that they took their time to listen to me. So nice, just so nice. He's not sober. That man is not sober, and neither is his wife. But they were there for me. They're like my Ebbies. You know, they help me. He told me to go to a meeting that night. Now, that guy's big as that door over there. I said, okay, you know. I said, but I don't want to go to that group my dad goes to. And he said, why? And I said, because I just don't want to go there. And he said, why are you so afraid? Are you just so afraid that your dad's going to be right? And boom, it hit me, you know. And he said, Sheila, that's pride and ego. And, you know, if you walk in with that, he said, you'll never get sober. He said, you better be at that group tonight, our group tonight. So I walked in and sat way in the back, of course. You know, I'm the back row kind of girl. And my dad walks in. He looked up like, well, hello, what are you doing here? You know, he's real old, and he was really shocked. And then he walked by, and I thought, well, I'm just here. It's open meeting. That's what I said. It's open meeting. Oh, what a sweetheart, huh? Wasn't I a nice girl? And they said, in our group, it says, if you have 30 days or less, will you please raise your hand? I kind of scratched my head and did that. And my dad happened to turn around, and he saw me. And he got called on for participation. And it was Christmas time, and he said, of all the Christmas presents I've ever, could ever have, this one is the very best. My daughter raised her hand. And I said, you know, I thought to myself, gosh, you know, that old man might love me. And we started very slowly. My sponsor said I had to do something nice every day for my dad because I lived in their house. I eventually had to come back there and live. And he left my sobriety alone, though. He gave me space. They both did. They worked good programs, and they watched me do stuff. I would just cringe if I saw me doing that. You know, if I saw my son doing that, I'd have just, whoa. I'd see him vibrate a little bit, but he never said anything. I know he's on the phone with Clancy an awful lot in those days, but my poor old Clancy, I drove him crazy too. But I just had to bring the paper in every day. He always read the paper. We were both morning people, so I'd go out and bring this cold time. It was cold sometimes too. I'd bring that dumb paper and I'd sit it down, you know, and I had to do it every day and never tell him why I was doing it or anything. I just did it. And I bring his paper in, and some mornings we could even talk about the headlines, and we both love sports, so we could talk about sports. And we kept it light and polite, you know, nothing heavy, not your opinion, my opinion. It was just real light stuff, you know, weather kind of things. And eventually this relationship started to grow, and I started to work the steps in this program, and I looked at Sheila's character defects instead of his character defects. And I started looking at me, and that's been the solution, and acceptance has been such a big part of my sobriety. I've had to accept the things that I could not change. You know, and I love the courage to change this week in the theme. You know, it does take courage to change. It also takes desperateness. And I was desperate when I got back here. I wasn't like coming in going, well, I'm pretty groovy. Of course, in my mouth, I probably thought that, but I was pretty desperate. This time my sponsor, I got this sponsor, oh my God. And I got the sponsor from hell. And which I needed. And I, thank you God, I had her. She said, call her at 6:45 every morning, you know. Not that I ever got up that time, mind you, but she did, and she liked a wake-up call. So my job from Monday through Friday was to call her, and we would visit at 6:45 in the morning. And one morning I woke up, and I had what she called it was impending doom, and I had fear. And I didn't even know what I was afraid of. I said, why am I so afraid? I said, there's nothing to be afraid of. It's 6:45. Nothing's happened today. And she said, Sheila, I want you to read page 86, 87, and 88 in the big book. Now, this woman is the big book, read, 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 read. I'm having a crisis, and she pulls out the big book, and it's like I want to thump her with it, you know? I'm having a crisis, by God. And she would say, I want you to read this and read this. And I read that, and it was just like I needed that. It was talked about, you know, we look at the 24 hours ahead, you know, and we calm down, and we ask God to do our thinking. We ask God for his will. It's just perfect, and I still read that, and my poor sponsorees are so sick of 86, 87, 88. Too, but that's all right. And they get to do that. And I have to do that. And it helped me, and it got me through that day, and I got up and I went to work. I got arrested when I was 90 days sober, which thrilled my whole family. I was driving with a suspended license, and I forgot about it, and I thought, oh, there's no computers in Oklahoma, so I just kept driving. And I got pulled over, and they threw me in jail, and I had all these fines and tickets that I didn't pay, and I was in trouble, and I had to call my dad, and I... And I was hours late, you know, and of course, you know, the first thought, whoa, you know, she's drinking, you know, I'm sure they were freaking out. And so they had the baby, too. They had my son. And so I said, and Benoit answered, and I said, hi. And she goes, where are you? I said, I'm in jail. She goes, ha, 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 ha. And I said, I am in jail. She goes, Jim, you know, and I, oh, God. And I could hear him screaming without the phone all the way to jail. Leave her there. Leave her there. He was so mad. And I kept saying, I'm sober. I'm sober. I'm sober. And the jailer's looking at me like, who cares, you know? And I'm like, I'm sober. I'm sober. And I was just bawling. I'm sober. Don't leave me here. So I'm sober this time. So Benoit came and picked me up, and she dropped me off at the clubhouse, our AA clubhouse. Like, I even wanted to be near AA at this moment. It's like I had just turned my will and my life over to God, and I got thrown in jail. So I wasn't really looking at the fact that this was the wreckage of my past, you know. That's what it was a wreckage of my past, and I hadn't cleaned it up. And I thought, well, if you'd given me a couple of months, I could have, you know. But so I had to go get this job, and that's where I went to work. And I worked, did nails during the day, and I still do nails, and I did nails during the day, and I did manicure, waitressing at night. And then after I got off work, I'd run over to the clubhouse, and if the meeting was in process, I had to be real quiet, and I could slip in. But a lot of times they would let me off right before the meeting because I'd work like 5 to 8, and I'd run over, and it was just, I mean, it was crazy. And then, but I had no car, so I had to get rides to all these things because I got my car impounded, and I couldn't drive into my license was suspended. So I did that for 2 months. And I called to get rides to daycare, to get rides to my first job, home from my first job, to my second job, to a meeting, to the daycare. And I did this. So when a newcomer says to me, I couldn't get a ride, oh, excuse me, no, 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 I don't think so. You've talked to the wrong girl, you know, because I know you can get a ride. I had to do it. It's humbling. It's horrible. But I did it. And today when someone calls me and says, can I have a ride? You betcha. You bet. You know, you bet. I mean, I know how hard that phone call is, you know, and people love me in this program. Women gave me things, you know, like a sweater. You know, I didn't even have underwear when I... Benoit kept saying, where's your underwear? Oh, I don't know. You know, I'm sure I didn't have... I'm sure I bought underwear when I was drinking. It's too expensive. And so, you know, those are the things that I came here with, you know, not a whole lot. And what I've gotten so much. I met a nice him. I did not date for 6 months. I went on this thing we call moratorium. I did those things. You guys heard of that, huh? It's good. Try it. You'll like it. Maybe. I didn't date, and I worked the steps, and I went to meetings. I worked 2 jobs. I learned to take care of my son. The ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon show me how to be a mom. You know, they show me how to be a mom. I went to conferences. I worked the steps. I made amends. You know, I made amends to my dad. It was his 20th AA birthday. It was like right around that week. And I told him, you know, Dad, I'm working on my, oh, God, it was so hard. I'm working on my, what? I said, well, when you have some time, I kind of like need to talk to you like private. He said, okay. And so it was like this one day, it was a Saturday, and there were all these people over. And he goes, Sheila, back room. And I go, oh, God, what have I done now? And I said, okay. And he said, well, didn't you want to talk to me earlier this week? And I said, oh, you mean like now? And he said, yeah. I thought, you know, and I said, well, there's, gosh, you're so busy. So I said to him, I told him, and I made direct amends. I told him that I was sorry for causing him the pain I had caused him in his life, and that I wasn't the daughter, just like what Reggie was talking about. I really loved that, that I was not the daughter that he had always wanted. And I was so sorry. And I told him I was sorry for having a child out of wedlock, that I know that broke his heart. Because, you know, dads and moms, they don't want those things for kids. You know, he wanted me to have a house and a picket fence and the 2.5 kids and the like Benoit says, the station wagon with the wood on the side. You know, that's what he wanted for me. And I know he was so hurt. And I told him I was very wrong and I'm sorry. And he said, I don't know if you remember, but when you were about 11 years old, I sat you down and I said some of these things to you. And, you know, I hadn't remembered because I was so full of anger and hate. And then I remembered. And I remembered he tried to tell me he was sorry for abandoning me. And he made amends back again. And we sat there and we cried and we loved each other. And all of a sudden my little son, who was about 2 or 3 then, he knocked on the door and he goes, Grandpa! You know, and we both just cried. And he came in and it's just, he said, and I just love this little boy so much. He just does. And he was Brad's, the first father figure that Brad ever had. So you see, it's just full circle, because when I needed him the very most in my life, he was there. He helped take care of my baby when I couldn't. He gave me a place to live when I needed one most. He gave me this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, by God, anything that he ever thought he ever did is gone. You know, it's just, it's erased. You know, he has done so much for my life. I can never repay him. And he gave me this program. I met another him, a musician, good God. He's not an alcoholic, but he's a musician, so they're just about as weird. And but he's a wonderful man. And I remember when Dad was going to meet him, and I said, well, what does he do for a living? I said, well, he's a musician. Oh, my God. And I said, now, Dad, I'm sober. I've been sober for several years now, and I, you know, my judgment's not quite as bad as it used to be. And he said, okay, so I met this wonderful man, and we dated. And we courted. I mean, it was slow. We got engaged at 2.5 years together. We were 2.5 years together before we got engaged. We were over 3 years together before we got married. And that's a miracle for me, because I don't know how y'all did it, but it was like you see each other, you meet, you stay together for 2 weeks, and you live together. That's my idea of a date. You know, that's dating. We dated. And then you break up, and you got to move your stuff out, and it's really a drag. You know, it's like, okay. So my sponsor told me, do it different this time. You know, do it different. And I tried. You know, I tried to just go slow. Because she said, he's going to be there. If it's God's will, he's going to be there. And I just, boy, I had to believe her. And it was tough. And I heard a man named Albert M. talk, and he said, you know, instead of trying to find the right person, try being the right person, and the right person will find you. And boy, that hit me like a ton of bricks. I remember hearing that, and I thought, it just sunk into me. We got married. And had an AA wedding, you know, and a musician AA wedding. It was very interesting. I wonder if anyone got 12-step there. But my dad gave me away, and my brother was there, my sweet brother, who came to this program for a little bit and then left. And I'm still praying for him. And the girls I sponsored were there. My sponsor was there. And it was just neat. My uncle who was a singer had died. He was an evangelist singer. He had died just right before that, about 5 months before that. And we played his tape, and it was neat. My aunt and uncle, the ones in Arizona, they came. They were at that wedding. And my aunt with the green dress, you know, she was there, my cousin, you know, and they came. And, oh, I just bawled all the way down. I couldn't even look at people because I was so overwhelmed with love. And it's just like, how did I ever get from there to here? You know, you couldn't even imagine. And I married the man that I really, truly love, and he's a nice man to me. He doesn't throw me through windows. He may want to, but he sure didn't take that action, you know. He may get a little frustrated with me, but, you know, he doesn't. And his brother is now over 2 years sober. He's about 3 years sober, and he married a girl I sponsored. I knew there was a drunk somewhere in that family. I just knew it, you know. There's just no way I'm going to fall in love with a normal kind of guy, you know. And I got pregnant right away. Good God. And I was just, oh, my God, I'm pregnant already. You know, I got pregnant like a month later. And I remember calling him and saying, tell him I'm sorry. You know, I said, well, I am. I'm sorry. We were going to wait a year and do all that, you know. And I said, well, honey, I'm sorry. He goes, well, why are you sorry? We're married. I go, oh, yeah, I forgot. How cool. I'm married. I'm going to call Dad. So, I asked him if I could tell my dad. You see, my dad was the last one to find out I was pregnant with my son, Brad. I was 5 months pregnant. Someone wrote him a letter because I couldn't tell him. And that's kind of the deal we had going back then. And I said to Dave, you know, Dave, I just always want to make amends. I'm living amends that way. And, you know, could we tell him first? And he said, yeah. And so I called him. I told him. I said, and I just want you to know that you're the very first one to know. You know, and I know that you were the last at one time. And I just want to tell you I love you. And we just cried, and it was so neat. And then my husband and I bought a house, and I was about 5 months pregnant. We got this house, and it was a total God deal. It just really was. And we got this house, and I'm going to hurry up and get done. And we got this house, and we went to, the next month was my 6th month. We went to the doctor for an ultrasound just for routine, and I found out we were going to have 2 babies. You know, I heard the saying that God makes the world round so you can't see too far up the road. In my 7th month, one of the babies got very sick. And I went to the doctor, and they said, Sheila, the baby's sick. I said, well, and one was a boy, and I just prayed the other one was a girl. And he said, the other baby, the girl baby, it is a girl baby, the other one, and she's sick. And I said, well, what do you mean sick? And he said, well, we need to concentrate on the healthy baby right now. So I went through this weekend. I had a whole weekend. It was an ice storm. And I wasn't going to go to a specialist till Monday, and I had to wait this whole weekend. It was just horrible. And, you know, my AA friends all came to my house. they were all at my house, and they just didn't want me to be alone and thinking, and they told me miracle stories, and you know how you are. You know, we get together if somebody's hurting, and, you know, we fuss and fight, and we talk about each other and stuff, but, boy, when somebody's in trouble, man, we just boom, we're right there for each other. And they came in an ice storm, too. You know, I'll just never forget that. I see the snow. Every time I see the snow, it just reminds me of that. And they love me, and they just carried me through that week, and I went to a meeting. I saw some friends of mine that I hadn't seen in a while, and they hugged me, and they loved me, and I went to that doctor on Monday, and I just was full of hope, and we went in there, and Dave's parents went with us, and that was so neat. They came with us, and he said, "I'm so sorry, but she didn't live, that the baby had died." And sometimes, you know, it's hard. Life's sad. There's sad things that happen. Even when you're sober, you don't get in a bubble. And what I learned through that was that only God can get me through those times. Gosh, my husband couldn't fix me. He wanted to so bad. The doctors couldn't fix me. My sponsor couldn't fix me. My sponsorees couldn't fix me. No one could fix me. And I remember sitting down at the table and I said, "God, will you please take this pain? Because I can't do it. And will you please walk me through the next few months?" I had to carry that baby until the end, one day at a time. And I lived in fear for the other baby. I was so afraid something happened to him. And I just prayed, and all y'all prayed. And I remember this girl came, and I met her one time, and she'd heard my tape, and she said, "I prayed for your baby." And I said, "Oh, you're so wonderful. Thank you so much." And he was born 4 weeks early. And next Friday, he will celebrate his second birthday, and he's a wonderful baby. And we are so, you know, we're so blessed that he lived. I remember a man from California who was a friend of my dad's, and he was an OBGYN, and he just called me because he just cared. I never had met him. He called, and he and his wife were taking care of my parents, who were, you know, they were in a lot of pain out there, and they loved my parents through this. And he said, "Well, I'm just going to take care of your dad, and I'm going to let him know you're going to be okay." And he called my doctor and talked to him. You know, this, I didn't even know this man, but I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a drunk, and I was in trouble, and he was helping. And that's the kind of stuff that happens in this program. I feel so blessed. I got to speak in Indiana a couple months ago. I was so really honored. And it was a young people's conference. And it was near the campus of Notre Dame. You know, I just thought, "Oh, that'll be neat." So this girl drops over, and we were going. Two girls I sponsored with me. And we went, and I said, "Okay." And we go tooling around. And we walked into this basilica. And it was the most beautiful thing. It was like I felt God all over me. It was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. It was just cozy and little, but it was just God was there. And I got down on my knees, and I was praying. And I looked up, and on the ceiling were like grown-up angels and baby angels. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that my baby was an angel. And I looked over, and I was crying, and my girlfriend with me, girl sponsor, she was crying too, and I looked at her and I said, "Carrie, my baby's an angel." And she said, "I know." And it was the most wonderful thing, and I could let her go, and it was okay. And that was because I showed up somewhere one more time, just showed up. You know, I just showed up. Someone asked me to come somewhere, and I just showed up because I was a drunk. And I got another healing in something that had been real painful for a long time. It was hard to let her go. And I kind of believe too, you know, my mother never saw her grandchildren. And I just said a prayer, and I saw the grown-up angel, and I thought, you know, maybe my mom's rocking her. Maybe my mom's taking care of her, you know, and God's taking care of both of them. I know that I can walk through just anything about anything in this program. You all have taught me that, and you've given me so very much. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are what will, for me, relieves the craziness and the insanity and keeps me sober one day at a time. And I did not have to drink through that, and I walked through that. And I love what they say, you know, you don't drink even if your butt falls off, you know. And sometimes your butt falls off, and you run out, and God will give you the power. Thank you so very much for having me.